welcome to remain standing, but you can sit down or you can go about your business, whichever would please you at this moment. We will not hold you here through these arguments, although I'm sure they will be very enlightening.
May it please the court, I'm James McKay and I represent the defendants. The district court abused its discretion by repeatedly permitting plaintiffs to attack Officer Merritt's character by painting him as a bad cop with a propensity toward violence. Because the gravamen of the complaint was that he used excessive force and because the testimony was highly conflicting, these errors had a highly prejudicial impact on the jury. Defendants are entitled to a new trial and moreover to judgment on plaintiff's claims. Plaintiffs asked Officer Merritt whether he had issues with anger. After defendants demanded proof, plaintiffs proffered that Merritt was, quote, found guilty by a trial board of beating up a woman at a club that he was involved with. The court permitted this line of question.
What was the nature of the objection, though?
The objection was that this is, I'll quote, we said this is evidence of prior misconduct to show on this particular date that he is consistent, which was not allowed by the rules. That's what we said. We objected, I think pointedly objected. This is one of various instances in which we were, this line of questioning was pursued and permitted by the court.
The district court didn't think the objection had been a 404B kind of objection, however.
Well, the district court in its opinion said so, but my view that under Rule 103A, this clearly is a sufficient identification of the problem with the line of questioning. This is only one of about four times, all of which were objected to.
Counsel cite Rule 404? Did counsel cite Rule 404?
Your Honor, he did not cite the rule, but he did say it's not allowed by the rules. You don't have to cite the specific rule in order.
Don't tell me what you don't have to do.
No, he did not, Your Honor.
That or not. I mean, you don't have to be silent on it either, counsel. You don't have to leave it out. You may or may not be correct that you don't have to cite it, but you certainly would be correct if you said you don't have to leave it out.
Your Honor, I just quoted what we said. We said this is evidence of prior misconduct to show in this particular date that he's consistent, and which is not allowed by the rules. That's what we said. Yeah. And despite this, plaintiffs proffered that it, yes, Your Honor.
At that point, he was setting it up for impeachment. Is at least the way I read the question, and that's why she let it in. I think the closer question is the closing argument.
Well, clearly, Your Honor, you get to this. As I said, this is there are several other cases during closing argument. The plaintiffs argued to the jury that he went ahead and asked Officer Merritt, were you convicted? He said flatly, no. I mean, I was charged. I was not convicted. Just one charge of conduct of becoming. Plaintiffs didn't try to impeach him, didn't pursue the line of questioning, didn't try to figure out what that meant. And on closing argument, plaintiffs told the jury that, yes, he was convicted, and which was contrary to the evidence. And the court compounded the problem by saying, well, I think that's what the evidence reflects, or I think that's close to what the evidence was, to quote the district court. And then the plaintiff went on to say, well, Officer Merritt was a bad cop on Monday and therefore a bad cop on Tuesday because he was a bad cop. He, quote, can't change to become a good cop overnight. Good cops don't get suspended from work. And that's what he told the jury. The district objected very clearly, saying this is an improper propensity argument. The trial court said move on, did not sustain the objection. The district, before the jury was discharged, asked for a curative instruction.
Again, the district court wasn't clear on that. I mean, the district court, when the conference ensued after the jury had gone in, said, well, you didn't ask for a curative instruction.
Well, he asked for, and he clearly asked, we asked for a curative instruction. We told this district court before the jury was excused, we want to make a record on this good cop, bad cop remark.
The district court was under the impression that that meant a record for appeal, not that there was a curative instruction. The phrase curative instruction wasn't used at that time.
Right? Record perhaps isn't absolutely clear what the district court thought, but the point is this. The point is that it would not have because this was a highly prejudicial remark, the district court did not sustain the district's objection to it. The district court said that, you know, by telling him to move on, that was the same, but it wasn't the same as sustaining. The district court did not strike the remark. The district court basically allowed the remark to go to the jury, and as I said, compounding it by saying, I think that's what the evidence was, about what the evidence was. And then the court could have perhaps cured this if it had granted the district's request for a curative instruction and said, well, no, just excuse the jury.
What was the request?
To instruct for a curative instruction that propensity.
Where in the record is that?
Well, what we did is at the about, let's see, after 358 somewhere. We asked for a curative instruction toward the end. It was before, right at the end of the argument, before the closing arguments, but at the end of the evidence. I'd say about records 377, 378 of our appendix, 377, 378, and we had asked for a curative instruction because there was no factual basis for it, and it was not a permissible argument. The point is that this is one of several occasions in which the district court permitted plaintiffs to paint Officer Merritt as an inherently violent person. This was the gravamen of the complaint, that he used excessive force. And essentially, the cumulative effect of all these errors, these evidentiary rulings, denied the defendants a fair trial. And
I did want to make, that was the first time there was a request for curative instruction, was after the argument was over. And
correct, Your Honor. That was the record 377, or my appendix 377, 378 was the first time we asked specifically for a curative instruction. But as I said, the fact that the district court permitted.
Wasn't that too late?
Pardon me? Well, I don't think so. Under the circumstances, I think, for one thing, the court told the district that it had to wait until it discharged the jury before it would listen to the district, the defendants, and the defendants very, obediently waited and then said, well, I wanted to make a curative instruction, asked for a curative instruction. The court said, well, I've just excused the jury. It seemed to be quite a bit unfair at that point because the court just excused the jury. He could have easily recalled the jury and instructed. And that would have perhaps done something to ameliorate the clearly prejudicial impact of plaintiff's good cop on Monday, can't be a good cop on Tuesday, you're a bad cop, inherently argument, which the court allowed. And that was one of the most prejudicial moments of this trial, where the court allowed plaintiff to paint Officer Merritt as a inherently violent person, and based on a proffer that where he turned up empty-handed. There was nothing on the record to indicate nothing, a flat
even
rejection.
Even if the proffer had been as favorable to the plaintiffs as they purported, that still would have been an improper argument, would it not?
Well, absolutely, Your Honor. It would have been. It's an improper argument. It had, because the evidence was highly conflicting, different stories.
What the evidence was, propensity is not
Correct, Your Honor. Propensity, certainly. You know, basically the jury, this court has said in several decisions that the jury is going to make the wrong conclusion from propensity. In other words, Your Honor, we believe that it was an unfair trial, and at least the district, the defendants are entitled to a new trial. We believe also that the Rule 50 motion should have been granted. Your Honors, you know, but basically to turn to that really briefly, the self-help that Clayton indulged in was just sort of self-help that Congress was intending to prevent when it amended D.C. Code 22405. And as far as if he had been sitting on his porch and beckoning Dorius up, he still would have been interfering with an arrest, but he wouldn't be using force. But here he did much more than that. He came down. He physically put himself between the officer and Dorius. He then dragged Dorius by the seat of the pants to the house, slammed the door in the officer's face, and I think that is a use of force. In any case, Dorius had no justifiable or excusable cause because he didn't know the facts. What happened, according to the evidence, which is not impeached, the officer Merritt, you know, heard threatening marks from Dorius and said he was going to lock him up. Now, Clayton up on the porch admitted he could not hear anything that was happening way across the street. So how could he know? How could he have justifiable cause? The excessive force claim, I think the officer, clearly the district, you know, should be vacated against it because there was no Monell argument here, and there's no responding superior liability.
Can I ask you,
yes, Your Honor.
Going back to the false arrest, this man was, what, 6'5", 300 pounds?
Kareem Clayton, the plaintiff, was 6'5", 300 pounds.
All right. And there's no dispute, I don't think, as to this. He interposes himself between Merritt and Dorius and pulls him into the door.
Yes, Your Honor.
Shuts the door. All right. At that time, 22405 was a felony.
It was at the time the council reduced it, but at that time in 2001.
All right. So that because she charged on fleeing felon.
Yes.
Now, did the district argue that? In other words, that the officers had the authority to go through the door with force in order to arrest a fleeing felon. I mean, that's what the jury was charged.
The issue of them going through the door, I don't think ever came up exactly. Pardon me?
If they're not after a fleeing felon, they have no business going through that door. And as far as I can tell from the testimony, the door was shut and locked.
Your Honor, the 1983 claim by Mrs. Husband was resolved against her, and she's not appealed that. Mr. Clayton did not, you know, he's a grandchild, and he came by and he was on the porch. But I think the basic point is it was a felony at the time until 2007. Number one, number two, it was. Under the Saucier v. Katz line of cases, including Broussard, you look at the other cases where you've got somebody intervening in the arrest, like the Wardlow v. Pickett case of this circuit, somebody intervening in arrest of somebody in this courthouse. And they said under Graham, it is not excessive force per se as a matter of law. So clearly under Saucier v. Katz and Broussard, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it is not clearly established that the amount of force the officers used in this case was excessive. And therefore, I think the officers are entitled to qualified immunity. I'll rely on my brief for my other issues, and I would like to have some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
No questions.
Can I ask
you,
one
Ken?
Question?
Wait. Don't go yet. Go ahead.
I don't think I got an answer. From my reading of the testimony, there is no dispute that whether or not Clayton opened the door through the board, through the weight, whether you just discount that.
Right.
There is no dispute that the door was shut and that the officers were not allowed into the house.
The the door was shut and the officers came through it. There was, as I said, the house was owned by Mrs. Hudson. It was her house. The only claim that she is pursuing is a claim of negligent infliction of emotional distress. She is not pursuing a claim of unreasonable search and seizure or anything else. That was resolved by the against her, and she has not appealed from that. So,
anything concerning her properly before us?
The negligent infliction of emotional distress is the sole claim that survived, the sole claim that is pursued in the cross appeal, nothing else.
What I'm questioning is whether your appeal of that case, the Hudson case, was valid, in which case, if it wasn't, then the cross appeal is not valid.
Well, we won the Hudson case.
Right. And you filed appeal. She did not. You can't appeal because you have a favorable result.
Well, no, but I thought, you know, but what happened is the plaintiff...
You didn't file a timely notice of appeal, did you?
Yes, we did, Your Honor. That was very... We filed two notices of appeal, both timely, and...
She didn't file a timely notice of appeal, did she?
Well, if she didn't file a timely notice of appeal, then, of course...
The only notice she filed was the cross appeal, and that would only have been timely based upon your appeal, and your appeal of her case was not... a valid appeal, was it?
Well, we filed an appeal from the only judgment against us, the judgment by the district court. We filed an appeal.
Yeah. She didn't have a judgment against you, did she?
Correct, Your Honor. We just simply, Corrine
My
Clayton.
Question, whether we have jurisdiction of anything concerning her.
Well, Your Honor, I will let... Mr. Latimer answered that, but we did file a timely appeal of the judgment against
claimant. Judgment, right? Ms. Hudson had no judgment. Am I right about that?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
She had no judgment against you. Am I right about that?
There was no judgment against the district in favor of Mrs. Hudson.
So you're for a prevailing party as to her?
Correct, Your Honor.
We would not have, there would be no jurisdictional appeal as to her, would there? She would have to file the appeal.
Yes, Your Honor.
She did not until after time had elapsed for the filing of an appeal. Filed a cross appeal. But if your appeal was not jurisdictional, then hers wasn't either, was it?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Let me go directly to the last question you raised. Ms. Hudson filed her appeal on May 15th. So irrespective of whether or not the original appeal or the second appeal was timely.
Was her appeal would be timely if there had been no intervening appeal filed by the district?
Her appeal is timely.
It was timely anyway?
It's timely anyway.
Even without an appeal by the district?
The district filed two appeals.
Oh, yeah.
It is timely.
Assume they have filed no appeal. And she was filing an appeal at that point. Would that have been timely?
If the district filed no appeal,
right,
then it would not be timely.
Right. And if the district's appeal is invalid, then how is she before us jurisdictionally?
If there is no appeal.
There was nothing to hold open her period of filing an appeal if the district did not have a valid filing against her.
If the district's original appeal and amended appeal mm-hmm. are not before the court, I think that the rules would still allow her appeal because her appeal was filed within the time limit prescribed for that appeal to be filed.
But it was not timely from the basis of when the judgment was entered.
It was not filed within 30 days of the judge's final order. That is correct.
Yeah, I don't know there's much point in us beating that horse any further. We'll have to wrestle with that among us.
All right. Let me address the other the other point raised by Judge Henderson. We talk about what happened in this case, but the district always wants to talk about this from the standpoint of the evidence in the light most favorable to them. There was no arrest in this case. There was no indication that there was an arrest going to take place.
You're talking about Darius.
I'm talking about Darius, right. Dorius is on the street. The testimony in this case, the light most favorable to us, is that the officer arrived on the scene. He began to beat Dorius. Dorius then ran across the street to Hudson's house, where Kareem Clayton was in the yard. The officer ran across the street. And yes, Kareem Clayton was 6'5 and 250 pounds, but Merritt was 6'7 and 290 pounds. Hackley was 6'3 and 275 pounds. So we're not talking about a situation where you got the plaintiff who is just the big guy. The officers were just as big or bigger than him.
There weren't any backcourt men out there. That
there weren't any backcourt men out there. So they're beating him with metal rods. They bust Clayton's head open when they get to the yard, completely open, break his arm. They then go to the door. He pulls Dorius in. Nobody, and there are other witnesses here who testified. These officers never said you're under arrest, never said anything about handcuffing you. It was just a beatdown. He then gets to his grandmother's door, pulls Dorius in because they're still beating Dorius on the porch. The officer then doesn't knock, doesn't ask to come in. They kick the door off the hinges. That's how they gain access to this house, and the beating continues. There were photographs shown of the blood leading from the door all over the kitchen.
So you're making probably a pretty good jury argument at this point, but you're making a jury argument.
Well, what I'm saying is this is what the jury heard.
Yeah, well,
this is what the jury based it.
The issues before this court.
The issues before this court are whether or not, under those circumstances, a reasonable juror could have concluded that, number one, there was an assault and battery. Number two, there was a use of excessive force. And number three, whether or not there had been a violation of 42 U.S.C. 1983. And I think that based upon the facts that the jury heard them in the light most favorable to us, that a reasonable jury could conclude that. I think that the only issues really before this court that have any real argument basis are the arguments that they make regarding alleged prejudice because of comments that were made. Let me address first the issue about what objection was made. The objection that was made is at page 223 of the appendix. And on 223, you will see that the question was, before we go any further, would it be fair to say that you have issues with anger? Answer, no. Question, would it be fair to say that you have issues with your veracity? Answer, no, no more than anyone else. And then there's an objection. And the objection is, I object unless there's some good faith belief that he can give a positive answer to these questions. And then we had a bitch conference. That was the only objection made with respect to those questions. We then had a bench conference where it was discussed that Officer Merritt had been suspended for a year based upon his interaction with a female at a nightclub and his lying about that incident to the police department. So we went into that whole scenario at the bench. And at that point, the court was advised as to how we were going to proceed, which was, if he answers these questions regarding what had happened truthfully, that would be the end of the inquiry. If he doesn't, then we will get into it. And you have to understand something. This was not a case where the officer was defending himself solely. The officer was also making a claim against Clayton for assault and battery. And the officer, in making a claim against Clayton for assault and battery, had alleged the following: that he and Hackley were acting above and beyond the call of duty. They went to this scene. They had not been called. No one had told them about anything, but they observed what they believed to be unlawful conduct. And because they observed this unlawful conduct, they then took action. In other words, now they're positing themselves as proactive.
Remember that you're not speaking to the jury now.
Well, yeah,
remember that we're supposed to be speaking to the legal issues, and you're getting very far back into your jury argument. So let's get back toward the issues here.
What our position is that, number one, the objection that was made was not the all-encompassing objection that they talk about. It was simply that there was no good faith belief to ask these questions. We demonstrated that there was. In terms of the oral of the closing argument, and
that's where you may have to do some talking. That sounds an awful lot like a propensity argument when you say you can't be a bad cop on Monday and a good cop on Tuesday.
And that was the reason.
What is the basis of that argument that's consistent with Rule 404?
Exactly why I was going into the scenario of what we were talking about here in terms of this officer.
Need to go into the scenario of the whole case. You need to tell me what the purpose of that argument is that's consistent with Rule 404.
What we were saying in this case was, and it was that this officer has told you that he was being a good cop. Mm-hmm. He was going above and beyond the call of duty. But in this case, you have heard this cop tell you five different stories. You've heard this cop tell you.
I want to read you a sentence from 404B. Evidence of other crimes, wrongs, or acts is not admissible to prove the character of a person in order to show action in conformity therewith. How was your argument consistent with the language of the rule?
Well, it doesn't show his character. What it shows is
said he was a bad cop.
No, he said he was a good cop.
You said he was a bad cop.
I said he was a bad cop because he said he was a good cop, that he is a bad cop.
You said he was a bad cop, and you said you had evidence that he was a bad cop, and you argued to the jury that he would have acted in conformity with that character.
No, I didn't. Right? What we argued was that you have evidence, and that evidence is his testimony before you.
He's a bad cop on Monday and a good cop on Tuesday. He's going to act in conformity with his character, right? I'm not hearing you tell me how your argument was consistent with 404.
Well, I think that when you come in and you swear to tell the truth and you don't tell the truth.
Well, you come in as an officer of the court and you have this rule, and the rule says you can't use evidence for a purpose, and you make an argument that sounds like that purpose, so that's an improper argument, isn't it?
Well, I don't think that was an improper argument. I don't think that pointing out to the jury that good cops don't lie to you, that good cops don't come in and swear under oath, that what I'm telling you is the truth, that good cops don't do the things that these cops have done. I don't think that violates Rule 404. What Rule 404 talks about are incidences and actions that have nothing to do with this case. But in this case,
and you talked to the jury about an incident involving a lady outside a nightclub that had nothing to do with this case. You're proving yourself wrong.
But that had nothing to do with propensity. What that had to do with was, again, and the reason...
You talked about conformity even with that character trait.
No, that's not what happened.
You said you couldn't be a bad cop on Monday and a good cop on Tuesday.
And that had to do with what you're talking about in this case. About that incident, what that incident went to had nothing to do with propensity. What that incident went to was this. This officer had testified that he hit Clayton in the head when he busted him open with a radio. The testimony at the scene was that he hit him in the head with an Aspaton. Now, the relevance of that is this. That officer, because of that incident with that woman, had been suspended for a year. Therefore, at that time, he had not been certified to use an Aspaton. And so the reason that he was saying that he hit Clayton with the radio was because he did not have the authority to use an ASP. And if he used an ASP, that would have been a violation. He was just coming back from a suspension. And because of that was the motivation for his lying.
How does that support the argument that you can't be a bad cop on Monday and a good cop on Tuesday?
That wasn't the reason for that.
What you just told me provide a reason for that argument that if he's got a bad cop's character, he's going to act in conformity?
Because if you are covering up your actions in order to benefit yourself, then that is not consistent with you being a good cop. If you will lie because it's in your self-interest to lie, that's not consistent with being a good cop.
And you're acting in conformity with that character trait on another occasion.
No, you're acting in conformity with that trait on this day. And that is the whole point. This had nothing.
But you wound it up by saying good cops don't get suspended from work.
That's right. His whole point.
You start with the fact that he was suspended, then you do the good cop, bad cop, and then you say good cops don't get suspended from work.
No, we started with the fact that good cops don't come in and tell you these kinds of stories when the facts are different. Good cops don't tell you that they hit somebody with the radio. Because if, and during the course of the trial, it had been established that if the radio, as the officer said, had been broken, he would have had to report that radio, and there would have been some type of reports that would have had to have been filed. So what we're saying is you don't come in and say that you did this when you know you didn't. You don't come in and make up these stories if you're a good cop. That's what we were saying. Now, was it articulated as well as it should have been? Maybe not. But the point is, this had nothing to do with other incidences. This was all about you.
Counsel, you can't get there from your argument. You argued about him being suspended for a year for misconduct. The very next sentence, you go into, you're not a bad cop on Monday and a good cop on Tuesday. You can't get to that. The point that you just tried to make. Your argument was that he had the character of a bad cop and that he must have acted in conformity therewith.
As I said, maybe it wasn't articulated as well as it should have been. The point of the matter is this
you
had
to get to that.
The point of the matter is
bad articulation. You said what you said.
And what we said was you can't come in and tell these people that you're a good cop and sue my client. You can't come in and say that you're suing my client and then want them to believe that when you told all the lies you told. That's what we were talking about. And I think that under the circumstances, when you're suing me, and he was suing me, when you're suing me, we have the right to attack your veracity. I think you have the right to attack veracity under any circumstances. But particularly here, we have the right to attack your veracity. And your veracity is in serious question when you're saying your whole case has been that we did everything right and that we were going above and beyond the call of duty.
You were not talking about veracity at the time you made that argument.
That's exactly what I was talking about. Absolutely.
I've got the record in front of me.
And I think that the trial.
They write these things down, you know. We see what.
You do, but you can't take one sentence or two sentences or three sentences. You have to read the entire context, as the trial court did. As the trial court did when the trial court sat there and listened to it. And the trial court, specifically, in ruling against them, said that argument was about credibility. Now, you can do that on a cold record because you have the power to. But the better part of discretion is to look at it within the context of what the trial court looked at it in, and that is the totality of the circumstances. Two sentences do not show what an argument is about. The entire context of the argument does.
Unless my colleagues have further questions.
I just have one question.
Right.
I know nobody's disputing it, but is it in the record the size of the two officers?
Yes.
It is?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Hopefully I won't take that. I just wanted to clear up one misstatement. Mr. Clayton suffered a broken finger, not a broken arm. His injuries were very similar to the gentleman Wardlow v. Pickett.
There again, we have read the record, and we didn't need the first jury argument. You don't need to.
No, no. I Your Honor, I just wanted to clear up that one misstatement. We believe that the district court erred in not granting judgment for defendants for the reasons we articulated in the brief, and to the extent that you do not
Why isn't that just a jury argument? I mean, that the jury heard all the evidence, and one view of the evidence is, as Mr. Latimer said, it was a beatdown.
Well, there is undisputed evidence, and the undisputed evidence, I think, because of the undisputed evidence, there's was no basis to send to the jury the excessive force claim or the assault or the false arrest claim. Clearly, the punitive damages were not warranted at all. There's no clear and convincing evidence of the elements. And in any case, we believe that at least the defendants are entitled to a new trial And to the extent that this court does not reverse the denial of our motion for judgment. Unless this court has any further questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Call next.